full-time stewards, those that have raced, who can make a little bit more of a subjective decision of whether that was right or wrong. And there's still going to be times they get it wrong, but I think that'll come with better racing.
Hello and welcome to the James Allen on F1 podcast brought to you by Autosport. This week we have a special interview with the newly minted F1 world champion team boss, Zak Brown. Zak has been the McLaren CEO since 2018, but it's taken him a few attempts to get the right team structure and management lineup to bring a first Constructors' World Championship since the heady days of 1998. Zak has run sports marketing businesses before. He was one of the top sponsorship brokers in the sport for over a decade. But an F1 team has many more moving parts and departments, all of which have to be high performing. So what was the secret to finally getting McLaren's recipe right to deliver the title? Does he regret not being a bit more ruthless at certain races last year, which might have given Lando Norris a shot at winning the driver's title? And do they start the 2025 season as championship favourites? We'll find out in a moment. Here to discuss this with me are Autosport's editor-in-chief, Rebecca Clancy. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, James. Thanks for having me.
And chief motorsport writer, Ben Hunt himself.
Hi, James. Yeah, I'm looking forward to this pod.
Rebecca, I'll start with you. I mean, full credit, you conducted this interview with Zak at the Autosport Business Exchange, which you and I hosted in London last week. Great event, really enjoyed it, great feedback. But how did you find Zak on the day? Was he walking taller as a world champion?
He was very good. When we asked him at the end of last year whether or not he could join us as our keynote speaker, and he was really up for it. And he arrived on the morning inaugural event. Everyone was refining our feet a bit. And he was on great form, chatting away, great, very happy to be there. He looks very well, I have to say. Looks like he's lost a fair amount of weight over the winter. I think he's been doing his own winter training like the drivers do. But no, he was in very good spirits. The initial question I said to him, you know, how does it feel to be world champion? He was very happy, big smile. I haven't seen him since he won it in Abu Dhabi. So just passing on my congratulations, big round of applause from the room. He's obviously relishing it. But as any team principal who has been in his position will tell you, that was last year.
Very true. Very true. Ben, before we get into the interview, just love your perspective on this. What makes Zak, Zak?
I think it's enthusiasm, passion. Those two things factor heavily for me. He is a former driver himself, so he has got that understanding of what drivers...
You'll hear it in the interview. He makes a point that he still drives.
I do apologise. Yes, he is a current driver. He's having a seat fit in two of his cars, wasn't he, last couple of days? So, he still thinks he's got the eye. He's got the ability to understand what drivers want and need, not only from the cars, but from the team. So he's a bit of more of a holistic approach, really. He's not an engineer. He is a marketing guy as well. So, you know, he understands that side of the business, the commercial side. I think he's just very rounded, and it's about getting it right. He's an insomniac. I know from people in the team, you know, he won't think anything about messaging them at midnight, not asking how they are, but just ensuring just a thought process, you know, have we got that stuff ready, you know, that sort of stuff. So he doesn't really switch off. I think that's where it's at. He's just super passionate.
Yeah, I think that's right. We've all had 5 a.m. texts from Zak Brown. So, okay, let's hear our interview with Zak. As I mentioned, he was in conversation with Rebecca in front of a select audience at the Autosport Business Exchange in central London, just a few hours before the spectacular new look Autosport Awards, where McLaren swept 3 awards. I hope you enjoy their discussion.
Zak, thank you very much. And I cannot start this conversation. This is the first time I've seen you since December. Congratulations on being the Constructors' Champions.
Thank you very much.
How does it feel?
Feels good. It was definitely nerve-wracking, the last race. I had a lot of people, 6-7 races out going, this thing's wrapped up. And it was like, I don't think this thing's wrapped up. And it came down to, as I described, 7/10 of a second on a pit stop, because Lando came out 1.6 seconds ahead of Carlos. I think had Carlos been in his DRS, we weren't great in the second sector. Even though Lando was quicker, you know, when you get into the dirty air, it wouldn't have been easy. So had we done a 2.2 second pit stop, had we done a 2.7 second pit stop, which is slow, but not a disaster,
outcome could have maybe been different because had Lando not won, given that Oscar was wiped out at the start, he made a good recovery, kind of like that. The outcome may have been different. So pretty exciting and really cool that it came down to McLaren versus Ferrari because that's what I grew up watching.
I love the fine details of Formula One and the detail you remember it in. We'll come back to the championship and the silverware that you received in December. I want to start at the very beginning, though, because when you joined McLaren in 2016, it wasn't in such a good place. McLaren finished sixth in the championship that year. The following year, they finished ninth. When you arrived, what did you see in front of you? And was it clear what the challenges were and what you needed to do there?
It was a lot worse than I thought. I came in knowing that things weren't in great shape. You know, you could see the brands on the car. You could see the results. But once I arrived, I realized it was really bad. And I had never run a Formula One team before. I'd been around Formula One my whole life. Was used to an organization that size. I'd run the agency I came from, we were about 1,200-1,300 people, so the size wasn't an issue, but the departments and the skill sets were definitely mostly out of my area of expertise. So I went about first kind of tackling the commercial side because that's where I was most comfortable and we needed a lot of resources. So I knew that would be the biggest contribution I could make in the short term. Changed the majority of the leadership team, but kind of one at a time once I got to know everyone. And took a while to turn it around. It was pretty toxic on the shop floor as far as the politics and, as Andrea calls it, poison biscuits. There was lots of poison biscuits being passed around. At the time, I think we were all convinced the problem was the power unit. And whilst that was certainly a big contributor, that was not exclusively the issue. And that became very clear once we changed and the results got a little bit better. But we knew we had fundamental problems, so it was quite a daunting task to tackle. But we got there in the end.
It hasn't been straightforward. You mentioned about Andrea Stella there. Obviously, there have been management changes. People have come in, they've gone out. 2022, perhaps not where you wanted to be, having been in place as CEO since 2018. Can you just talk about some of the challenges faced then, and also acknowledging perhaps mistakes were made, that there were issues, and going about making those changes that were needed?
Yeah, so if you kind of go back, and obviously everyone in this room knows how Formula One works in the lead time, our success in 21 was really the credit of the team in 2019, which was Pete Bedromo, Andrea Stella, Gilles Deferrin, Pat Fry, and then, of course, everyone that was there. Gave us a pretty good race car. You go into 20, and then when COVID hit, the only difference between our 21 car and our 20 car, because we had to use these tokens, was change into the power unit, and I think the Mercedes is the class of the field. And then we won, and everyone kind of looks at 21 and who was in place then and went, I've done a wonderful job, when really you got to give the credit to that 21 car, to our 2019 team. The 22 car, kind of credit to those that were around in 21. And because we had our driver issue, Daniel Ricciardo, that became the headlines. But underneath that, I felt that we weren't progressing and the car wasn't that good. And then we had a big upgrade in France that didn't work. And the response from the leadership after that upgrade failed was kind of business as usual. And that was when the red flag really went up for me that we've got an issue. And then, of course, in the middle of the year in 22 is when you're developing your 23 car. I had asked Andrea Stella to become the team principal back in 1920, but he felt he wasn't ready yet. Andrea has very little ego, so he's not one of these individuals that jumps at, oh, it'd be great to be team principal. He just felt he wasn't ready, even though I felt he was. So the second time around, I had the opportunity to make some changes. Did technical director, team principal, head of aero, convinced Andrea, which again, when I made him the offer, it wasn't an immediate yes. He had to sleep on it over the weekend, get comfortable with it. But then when he jumped in, he got real serious real quick. identified that we were going to have big problems, which I suspected, hence the change. He made a very brave decision, which was to tell everyone we were going to have a terrible start to the year, which I think was the right decision because everyone was going to be able to figure that out 30 days later. He was spot on. We were terrible. But at the same time, we knew the development was really starting to ramp up. So we kind of had to manage people externally and internally to wait for this latest, greatest upgrade in Austria and hope that it worked. And it did. And that was the work of Andrea and everyone, obviously, in the factory and the leadership he provided. And then all the upgrades have kind of worked since we've bolted them on since Austria, which has been pretty impressive.
You mentioned there about culture. By no means an easy thing to change, and obviously switching a few things, people around within leadership, but then you have beneath that 1,000, 1,500 people. How do you go about changing that culture and getting everyone on board with your message when perhaps they're not used to the direction that you've been going in?
I think kind of middle and upper management as opposed to top management are critical because I have 10 direct reports, and then my 10 direct reports probably have 10 direct reports, but we, you know, we're about 1300 people at all of McLaren Racing, about 1,000 of those on Formula One. So the people that have the kind of the biggest influence with the largest group of people is that next layer of management that probably we touch 600 people in the organization. So, you know, it's easy to put on a PowerPoint. Here's what we want to be. You got to walk the talk, but then you need to make sure that permeates through the entire organization. I think we have been extremely transparent with our team, taking all the politics out of the team. I remember three guys from the gearbox early on came in ahead of the open door policy, came in to see me, and these were early days, but this was kind of the conspiracy theories we'd have on the shop floor. And they came in to see me and they said, we're really concerned for you. And I was like, why is that? And I won't name names, but they saw three people talking. It's not good. We think it's about you. I was like, well, what'd you hear? Nothing, but we think it was bad. And it was like, but that was the kind of the ghosts that people were seeing in the conspiracy theories on the shop floor. And so we got that out of the system, and very transparent, definitely a no blame culture. You know, it's so easy in the sport. It's very frustrating that if you make a mistake, driver makes a mistake, strategy, tire, mechanical, to kind of get angry at that person. And that's very unhealthy. You win and lose together. It's a team effort. And so I think it's been very healthy for the team that the last few races were really difficult for us. Qatar was obviously difficult for us. Brazil didn't go our way. Vegas, we weren't competitive. So right as everyone thought we had this thing wrapped up, probably, you know, we had 14 podiums in a row and then three bad races leading into the last race. So to have the team respond with a 2-second pit stop when it counted in Abu Dhabi, I think was the great resilience of the team. And I think we're going to be strong this year.
To go back to the point you were making about the honesty, I remember being at testing in 23 and you guys came out and said, yeah, we missed our development target. This isn't happening. We're going to be rubbish. Bear with us. And it was a change from what we used to, let's say, in the media. Was that your decision to just front up and be like that? And how was that received within the team? Because that could be negative for morale. You could see a way it would be.
Yeah, it was actually led by Andrea. And Andrea and I talk a thousand times a day. I think we very much complement each other, have different skill sets, and I don't think I've ever enjoyed working with someone as much as I have Andrea, and he's very transparent, very honest. I think the team appreciated it. And it was a way they were all going to figure it out. I mean, a lot of people knew because they know the data, but those that didn't, but we immediately went into, we're going to fix this. And, so I think it actually helped morale that we just told them as it was. We didn't blame anybody. We didn't blame a power unit partner. I mean, we couldn't. Mercedes was definitely not an issue. But, you know, I think it was refreshing for the team because when I joined and I kind of sat back and listened to a lot of the people on the team that are no longer there, there was a lot of, it wasn't my fault, it was a his or her fault, or it was our partner's fault. And it was a lot of blame. And I think people, it kind of doesn't matter who's faulted is we're all on the same race car, so we just need to work together. So I think the team very much appreciated that.
Moving to last year, you said you didn't really know you or think you were in the fight until eight races out. How was it at the start of the season? Because you certainly weren't in it at the beginning. Red Bull looked like they would go on and dominate as they had done. And then slowly Lando got the win in Miami. And then we thought that would be the catalyst to just push him forward. And there was a bit of a stumbling block. And then it went again. What are you saying to the team internally when it does start to ramp up and you're thinking, hang on, mathematically, we are in this and we are getting down to the business end? How do you keep people grounded and focused on what they're doing?
I think you don't change what you've done. I got asked a lot, you know, towards the end of the season, what are you going to do differently? And I was like, no, we need to keep doing what got us to where we are. I think probably my own personal goal coming into the year was if we could finally get Lando's win done, that would be a nice accomplishment. Maybe win a second race. I don't think it was until Hungary that I really felt actually we might be able to win the constructors. I never thought it was a done deal. You're on pit wall and you're kind of calculating the points every lap of every race towards the end. So it really wasn't until Hungary where we had a really dominant performance. Obviously it came with some drama, but that was kind of the McLaren I grew up watching, was front row and two cars essentially checking out. So Miami was great. I think at that point it was, let's just see if we can win another one or two. But I don't think we changed much. We made mistakes over the course of the year. I think there's some races that we can point back to that we didn't execute like we should have, and we maybe even doubted ourselves. But I think I always tell everyone in the factory, mistakes are okay, just don't make the same ones twice. So Silverstone, we should have won that race. We know the mistake we made, we know why we made that mistake, we won't do that again. So I think you can look back and go shoulda, woulda, coulda, and of course you kind of do that, but it's over. But what's important is we learn what happened in Silverstone, and we knew that don't do that next year in Silverstone.
You did an interview with my colleague Ben in Singapore, I think it was, and you were talking about how you try personally and shoulder a lot of the responsibility to the point of making yourself sick at times. How were you by the end of the year?
I was pretty stressed. Abu Dhabi was the worst 2 hours. You know, and it shows how quickly Formula One can change. Saturday, we're first and second. Charles is 17-18th because he has his penalty. And then turn one in Sunday, what should have been a bit of a cruise home. Charles has an unbelievable start. He's in the top 10, 2-3 laps into it. Oscar's back in the back of the pack. Lando was on fire, but we knew if Ferrari finished second and third, we had to win. We didn't communicate that to Lando. I think we just let him do his thing. He drove a perfect race. But anything could have happened. You know, you're worried about safety cars. So there was a couple battles there at the end with some wings coming off. So you're just very nervous that anything can change at any time, as we've seen, including Abu Dhabi, you know, a few years ago. So that was on my mind when you start seeing cars tussle. I was looking more at our data going, I hope no one's racing each other because they can affect our race. So that was very stressful, but I think it made the victory all that much sweeter.
I feel stressed listening to you. You now go into this year with the target on your back. Lando is the bookies' favorite for the drivers, McLaren the favorites for the constructors. How do you approach it now that you are on top and you are the ones being chased?
I think pick up where we left off in Abu Dhabi, have more confidence in our decision making. You know, I talk about Silverstone. I think we doubted ourselves, that we knew what to do. We actually had a plan and we went off plan, which was stupid of us. And so, well, I think now we've got some confidence that we know how to lead again, and we will do that differently than we did this year. I think the field's going to be even tighter than last season. I see the top four teams being just as tight as they were at the end of the year. I wouldn't be surprised. You see the turnaround we had, so there's no reason why other teams can't have that type of turnaround. So I think we're in store for an epic season. And I think last season, had Red Bull not run away with it at the start, I think you would have had an unbelievable 3-4-way driver championship and four teams fighting for the constructors. And I think that's probably what we'll see this year.
I think you also might have in store quite a big headache with your driver lineup. I said about Lando being Bookie's favorite, but Oscar Piastri is a phenomenal driver, race winner. He definitely won't accept being a number two driver. We know towards the end of the year, he was asked, obviously, when it was mathematical to support Lando, but he in himself is a winner, wants to be champion. How do you go about managing what is probably one of the most exciting driver lineups on the grid?
Yeah, it's going to be fun this year. No doubt about it. We like our guys to race. I think we showed that we're racers. We don't want to be a one car team. We have rules. The drivers are very respectful of those rules. I look at Monza. I think we could have done a better job of communicating there. You know, we went into turn four, first and second, came out first and third, probably cost us the race. I think that was on us, not necessarily on the drivers, because we weren't explicit in our instructions. We kind of gave them some guidelines, but I think when next time around, we need to be explicit. Hungary ended up being the right result. I always knew Lando was going to give it back. He maybe waited a little bit longer than we thought he would, but he did the right thing, as he did in Qatar. In fact, in Qatar, we told him not to because it was such a close race, and he decided to anyway. So I think that shows the relationship and the respect they have for each other is they kind of owe each other a little bit. And Lando on his own went, I owe Oscar one for Brazil, and took that upon himself. So they get along great. Of course, they're extremely competitive. And I think the secret to success there is being very transparent, very fair, very balanced in communicating. So on Thursday, here's what we're looking to do this weekend. Sunday, once we know how qualifying's gone, here's how we're going to race together and against each other. And for sure, there's going to be, I don't think there's any way to think that the two of them aren't going to have some tussles at some point. But we know how to race each other together. We won't let the media kind of flare up the intensity, you know. So kind of if something does happen, leave the helmet on. Let's not talk to anyone yet. And then let's relax, talk about it, and then we'll come. You know, don't take the bait, because obviously
I can't promise you what.
Everyone obviously would love to see a little bit of rivalry between the two of them. So we need to protect them from the industry, if you'd like, that might like to see a little bit of a Lando Oscar wrestling match.
Who gets involved with the driver conversations? Is that yourself? Is it Andrea? Is it very much sort of team approach?
Very much Andrea and I on those types of issues. Obviously, from a technical going racing standpoint, then we leave that to the engineers. But when it comes to relationships, how we want them to race, how we want them to conduct themselves, that's very much Andrea and I sit down with the drivers the start of the weekend, and then most importantly, race day morning when we've developed a strategy. I think that's one of the areas I like to contribute to. I've got a great relationship with the drivers. I love racing myself. So I think that's, while I can't do it as fast as them, I at least understand mentally what it's like to have a helmet on and the stress that comes with and the emotions and the passion that comes with. So I think that's an area of strength from a relationship standpoint.
We are facing down a 24-race season. It is a lot. It takes its toll on everybody, drivers, mechanics, personnel, everybody involved. As the man in charge of that team, how do you manage that? And how do you yourself approach it?
For me, it's quite easy because I've been a track rat my whole life. And we've obviously got the IndyCar team, the Formula E team. I've got my own team that races in Le Mans. So I'm in a racetrack probably 40 weekends a year. I bring my wife and family with me to a lot of them. So for me, it's a lot of travel, but I've been doing it forever and kind of in the zone. For the team, we are starting to get into some rotational aspects. And then I think family is very important. We make sure we look after, especially our traveling group, their family. We host a lot of events. We let the families come to races when we can, and let them know that, because I think it's easier for those that are on the road. We're having fun racing in Monaco, but it's the sons, the daughters, the partners that, you know, we're sitting at home watching, you know, mom or dad or brother or whatever the case may be, a million miles away. So taking very much a family approach to it. We've just put a new state-of-the-art gym in, canteen, so we invest a lot in kind of everyone's mental and health and their well-being, and I think they know that. So the more we can make it a very comfortable work environment, upgrade hotels, things of that nature. But it's a brutal schedule. I think now with 24 races, you know, we can all kind of troop it out, but I suspect there's going to be some fatigue in 3-4 years that the sport's going to have to deal with.
And finally, I just wanted to ask you about the FIA. I can't not. The governing body has been in the headlines, perhaps not for the reasons that they would like recently. Changes to rules about how they governance, the directive coming down about swearing and any offensive behavior against the drivers. All companies have to deal with external factors, with politics. They're obviously, as I mentioned, the governing body. What's your view on the state of the FIA at the moment?
Well, they're driving a lot of change. I think the swearing I agree with in certain circumstances, meaning, you know, in a press conference where everything's quite chilled out and there's no emotion involved, there's no reason to swear. You don't see Michael Jordan in a NBA. I know I'm dating myself because he's not played for a while, but you know, you don't see these athletes, managers in a press conference just dropping F-bombs. So I think that's inappropriate, and we should set a good example. I think when the helmet's on, you're in the heat of the battle. I would imagine on a football pitch or a baseball field, there's a lot of stuff that we just don't hear because they're not mic'd up. I think we do have the power to hit the delay button or delete on broadcast. So I think you can't control it to a certain extent when the helmet's on, but you actually can control whether it makes it onto TV or not by just hitting the delete button. So if we don't like that or we feel it's too much or too inappropriate, then just don't broadcast it. I think showing the emotion and the passion and the intensity is good. So I think a little bit of it is okay, but we've got the power in the production studio to hit the pause button. So I think that's how you solve that, because I think it would be unrealistic to say you can't swear when the helmet's on.
Have you been known to swear with the helmet on?
I think everyone has sworn with a helmet on. I think the biggest thing we need to do is tackle the approach to the stewarding system. To have part-time, not paid stewards. Where, you know, here we are in a multi-billion sport, $1 million sport, and everything's on the line to make the right call. For so, I wouldn't want to be a referee in any sport, right? You know, whether it's football or motor racing. You know, it's kind of a thankless job. You get it right, no one says great job. You get it wrong, you have the whole stadium booing you. But I don't think we're set up for success by not having full-time stewards. I think the individuals are fine. I think they're racers. And then I think the rule book is too prescriptive. You know, this whole, you know, you got to whoever's at the apex first, but then they didn't think through. But what if you actually can't make a corner? I think Max has done a great job of absolutely understanding what the rules say. So I'd like us to take a step back, loosen it up, full-time stewards, those that have raced who can make a little bit more of a subjective decision of whether that was right or wrong. And there's still going to be times they get it wrong, but I think that'll come with better racing, because you also then get into things like at the apex, you take turn one at Austin, the apex is actually around the corner. And so then you start getting into that debate. So I think if we have too many rules, no one's actually sure what the rules are. So we just need to go back to kind of what worked in the good old days.
So permanent full-time stewards, same stewards at every single race, or that it could affect the racing?
Well, I think we have seen it's affected the racing. I think we can all point to incidents that we don't think were right. But they might have been right based on what the rules are. So I think it's not just the stewards. I think it's the rules around the racing that need to be loosened up, not tightened up.
Within the team, you mentioned there about Max, and I think we'd probably all agree he's very good at knowing the rules and where to push them. As a team, then, do you have to say to Lando, to Oscar, this is the rule, this is the line?
Yeah, we've had a lot of discussions about that, but I'd rather see the rules change than everyone adapt their driving style to what the rule book is, or we're going to just live in a world of everyone dive bombing for the apex, not worrying about whether they can make the corner, and then arguing about the rule. So I think we need to do the rules and the stewarding and get back to the racing that we've all seen, as opposed to racing to the rule book.
Rebecca, I really like the line of questions you had on culture. Let's start there, because he had a big turnaround on his hands. And it reminds me a lot of what Jean Todt found when he went into Ferrari in the early 90s, that the problems were much more severe than he'd seen even from the outside. And it was exactly the same situation, that there was this blame culture. You know, is it the engine? Is it the chassis? Everybody kind of pointing the finger, and the poison biscuits, as they call it within McLaren. And so it was up to him then to change that culture and to drive collaboration through trust.
Yeah, and this was obviously a business exchange. So we very much wanted to focus on the business side. It's very easy with Zach to get sucked into talking about racing, and he's so enthusiastic about it. And it's wonderful to talk, as I did later in the interview, about the drivers and that side of it. But he is a brilliant businessman. And so that's why he was such a fantastic keynote speaker for us, because I personally find it really fascinating about the culture. As I said at the start, he came in 2016, at the end of 2016. They were at sixth in the constructors, and then they slipped to ninth, and then there was a bit of a reshuffle. He moved up to being CEO in 2018, and the buck stopped with him, and he knew it stopped with him. And one of the things that, you know, we all thought it in the media at the time, this American coming in, he doesn't really have any F1 experience. What is he going to do with the sport? Okay, we were having similar conversations about Liberty as well. And it was just that kind of, we weren't really used to this brash, bold American coming in, and he was making change. He was being very honest, which was very refreshing from the media point of view. And he just very quietly in the background started enacting change. And change in culture is incredibly difficult. So I was really fascinated by how he had gone about that. And as you say, James, it was eradicating that blame culture. Every team up and down the paddock says it. We are a team of 1,000, 1,500, 2,000. It's not one driver. It's not one engineer. It's not one designer. We all have to work together for this to work. And it's very much, for, as Zach was saying, you come forward with your ideas. There is no stupid question. It has to be a complete holistic shift in every single department, you know, down to catering, comms. Every single department had to be involved and had to get on board with what he was saying. And he makes a brilliant point that actually all he really needed to do, a couple of people at the top, and they had a bit of a change around, and that was enough that, you know your limitations. He's saying, I have 10 or so people reporting to me, and then they have 10 or so people, and it's that line of management. They're the ones who make the difference. And I found that really fascinating.
Ben, I really like what he was saying about looking after the families. I mean, when we're talking about the wider cultural piece, you know, understanding what it's like to be a family. We all know this because we've all lived it ourselves for many, many years, and the pressure that we put on our families by being away at Grand Prix. And it is relentless. I mean, you know, he mentioned the lots of family events and making the spouses and the kids really feel part of it all to make up for those long absences abroad of their loved ones. You know, it goes a long way, that kind of thing, doesn't it?
It does. And it was also reminding me of a piece that I'd done recently about Lewis Hamilton being at Ferrari, and how you mentioned Ross Brawn and Jean Todt, but I was thinking of Schumacher and the way that he went into Ferrari and sort of endeared himself to the mechanics. He spent a lot of time getting to know their names, getting to know whether they're married, whether they had children, trying to find out their birthdays, children's names. And I think that approach is the right approach. It's kind of, you know, I speak about football quite a lot on these podcasts, but, you know, if you think of a manager, the arm around the shoulder type approach and trying to get the best out of your team in that way, that's kind of what Zach's done. He's made the effort to, you know, get to know everyone within that team and find out what makes them tick. And key to that is Andrea Stella, You know, for me, it was interesting. I've spoken to him a lot, but there was one moment where he said, you know, for him, the red flag was after the French Grand Prix, I think 2022. And they brought some upgrades and they didn't work. And the reaction from the management at the time was, oh, well, never mind. We're back to the drawing board. And he said that that was a red flag for him. He couldn't understand why they were just so relaxed and calm about the fact that this upgrade hadn't worked. And that was the moment that convinced him that he needed to make the change, which I thought was fascinating. But there was another element as well. When I spoke to him in Singapore, I wanted to sort of get into his sort of management technique and it was about how, you know, he stays at the top and what drives him. And he said that he's actually driven by the fear of failure, not for success. He doesn't think about winning. It's more about failing on his watch. And he adopts that same principle, like all the way through. If you look at it from a commercial point of view, he's not worried about, keeping those sponsors sort of on the books just temporarily. He wants to keep them all the time. We mentioned the poison biscuits thing. He knows that teams will be going after his sponsors. So he's worried about not retaining those sponsors, not for the next couple of years, but the long-term deals. He's trying to keep them on board, on side, you know, for as long as he can. And it's that motivation of failing, losing a sponsor, losing a driver, losing a key personnel. That's kind of where he's at. And if you add it all together, so you've got that arm around the shoulder technique, looking after people, it's kind of preserving the relationship, preserving that momentum and trying to not let the poison biscuits poison the culture. So it's kind of an interesting one. If you factor in the fact that I mentioned before that he's a bit of an insomniac, he's doing some balancing act there, trying to keep everyone happy and moving in the right direction.
I think you put your finger on something there, that sort of anxiety, that anxiousness. There's the relentlessness, the fact that he's always on, he doesn't switch off. But then he's also got that. And Jean Todt was the same. I remember him saying once, I'm always anxious. And he and Zach are both part of the famous Formula One nail biters club, along with Alain Prost and a few others, myself included. But, always feeling anxious. There's always something to be, you know, concerned about. You're never complacent. And so no wonder that he got that red flag, like you say, when the upgrades didn't work. But, you know, he's always very quick, isn't he, Rebecca, to credit Andrea Stella with the leadership of the team and that drove that world title success last year. I was really interested to hear him say in that interview, it's the first time I've heard him say it, that he enjoys working with Andrea more than anyone he's ever worked with, which is a hell of a thing to say. I mean, considering how close he was to people like John Hogan, who was like this guru of sponsorship, and Zach had him as a mentor. I mean, they were inseparable. There's so many other people you could say, and it's quite a compliment to Andrea. What's your perception, Rebecca, of what that chemistry is based on?
So Andrea Stella is loved very much in the paddock, and he actually won the Autosport Award for Person of the Year. And what happens is that's voted for by the network. And I just sent out an email to the entire network, and I said,
all the journalists,
everyone. It went out to the entire team, the entire network. And I said, who do you think which person of you has made the biggest difference, biggest contribution, you know, the few other points that were in there. And it was overwhelming, the number of people who voted for Andrea Stella. I think Zach Brown himself would have absolutely voted for Andrea Stella. One of the really interesting things from that interview that I had never heard before was that he had actually tried to give Andrea Stella the team principal job in 2020. We were all talking amongst ourselves afterwards. None of us knew that. That was brand new information. And then within that interview, I obviously asked him about 22. It was a bit tricky with Daniel Ricciardo. Ben touched on the upgrade. Andreas Seidel was team principal then. It wasn't quite working out. And Zach's been very honest about that relationship since. Seidel left. And then he finally got his man in Stella. And we know Stella. He worked at Ferrari in the glory years with Todd and Schumacher. He's just very calm. He's a very nice guy to talk to. There's no sensationalism. There's nothing, you know, the emotions aren't all over the place. He's quite kind of a level-headed person. He's a fascinating guy to talk to. The level of detail that he can go into, the engineering brain, and I think that's where they really complement each other. You know, Zach is the commercial man. Stella is the engineering brain. They really work off each other. They completely trust each other. You do your job, I'll do my job, and then we'll come together. You know, and Zach was talking about it in the interview with the drivers, for example. They can approach that together because they have the different skill sets and they really complement each other. And ultimately, we have seen the results. And I think credit to Zach as well, because he came in. It's been a while, 2016. It's taken him a while to get to the team. He was patient. He got the man he eventually wanted. When he faced hurdles, he just addressed them straight on. And he's now where he is. And I think Stella has been a huge part of that. And even from the media point of view, our point of view, dealing with him, it's been great. So I can only imagine what he's like to have as a colleague.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned there that Andrea was raised in that Jean Todt, Ross Brawn, Michael Schumacher, the sort of white heat of Ferrari, and that won everything in the 2000s. And, you know, for me, it was surprising, to be honest, that given that background, that he wasn't more ruthless in pursuit of the Drivers' Championship when it was there for the taking in the second half of last season. We've touched on this podcast before, but for me, it was interesting to hear Zach. You know, he's aware of that criticism of himself and particularly Andrea Stella, that they didn't go for the jugular when clearly Verstappen was floundering, the car wasn't working, and they missed that opportunity to sort of put all their eggs in one basket and go for the drivers, which for sure Jean Todt or Ross Brawn in that situation would have done, and as would other team bosses. What did you make of that?
Well, I thought that that was just part of him being cautious. If I go back to what I said earlier on about being driven by fear, he's in this position of seeing an unthinkable turnaround halfway through 23, and then to start off 24 in a better place and then carry that momentum. I think that there is a cautiousness about changing the mentality of the team, because if you start meddling, then you can see it all go terribly wrong. And I think that there was a lot of hesitant decision making with regards to swapping drivers around and prioritizing Norris, and I think that's probably where it comes from, you know, an inexperience of dealing with the pressure at the sharp end and being ruthless. I mean, how many times last year did we hear the phrase, you know, we're learning, we've learned from our mistakes, you know, they were constantly learning. That's Zach, that is Andrea, that is McLaren, that is everyone within the organization, and constantly faced with new challenges and learning how to deal with it in the right way. They were trying to be diplomatic. They weren't going to favor one driver over another while the other was still in the championship mathematically. We're sitting there from the outside saying, just back one, back Norris, come on, it makes more sense. And of course, from our point of view, you know, it does, but we're not working with the other side. We're not working with Piastri's team and everything else. And they're trying to maintain a level of harmony, which is really difficult to do in Formula One, as we know. So I think it is just that cautious approach. And of course, the learning, what have they learned? I think that is one of the key things coming into 2025, is what they've learned from last year dealing with the pressure of running at the front. I know that Norris says he now knows what he needs to be a world champion, and it comes down to mentality. You know, he's had the experience of banging wheels with Max Verstappen and coming off second best on most of those occasions. And he knows that he needs to be more ruthless. Now, do the team also need to be more ruthless coming into 25 as well? I suspect so.
Well, that's the question. I mean, for sure, Norris only has a chance if he is more ruthless. And the thing is, though, you know, you don't get that many chances necessarily, you know. I mean, they can be satisfied with winning the constructors, but I'm sure it does bug them a bit that the driver's there for taking. If you just take a snapshot after Silverstone, which Zach in the interview admitted they made some mistakes, that they had a plan and they deviated from it, and they lost the race as a consequence. But coming away from Silverstone into that second half of last year, Verstappen was on 251 points, but was really struggling with the car, clearly. Norris had 171 and Piastri was way back on 124. So if they found themselves in that situation again in 2025, Rebecca, whichever driver is ahead, whether it's Norris or Piastri, what do you think they'll do?
I'm not sure I mean, it all depends in terms of, Mercedes always had the luxury, didn't they, in the height of their dominance, that they had the two drivers fighting against each other and the other teams weren't in the mix, so they could let their drivers fight. I suspect it won't quite be the same for McLaren. I think we actually have got a brilliant fight on our hands between the top teams this season. I see the, you know, Budapest was the turning point where we were all screaming at our TVs at the screen saying, Don't make Norris give up the win. It's ridiculous. He's in for the championship. What are you doing? But to Ben's point, it's about the inner harmony and the long-term gain from that short-term pain, as it was, because you need two drivers on board. You need both drivers pulling in the same direction. I know all the glory rides with the driver's title, but ultimately all the money is on the constructors. So for Zach, he's done his job. He's delivered. The bonuses are paid out to the staff. They're enjoying their new kitchens now, or whatever they've spent their money on. And all the sponsors are happy because they pretty much sign into winning the Constructors' Championship. It's the car, but it's the glory. We all know the glory lies with the drivers. So I think next year they'll find themselves in a difficult position. And, you know, I asked Zach in that interview about it's potentially his biggest headache. And it really, really is. I think the car is in a good place. I think as it always does with Formula One, it will come down to the development race, as in, when do teams start switching to 26? Who's still concentrating on 25? It's going to be a really fine balance between juggling that. But I sort of think McLaren will still play it a bit safe with the drivers. And I think that could be their downfall. However, I think with the likes of Piastri, who is excellent, Norris obviously brilliant, I think that we're going to start to see some internal tussle.
I think you make a very good point there, and I'm sure Neptune Kitchens and other suppliers are very grateful for the fact that they played it the way they did. But no, you make a very fair point, and it certainly gives us a tremendous narrative going into this season. I mean, it was mentioned that McLaren have gone from challengers to having the target on their backs. They start the season as favourites for the drivers and the constructors. Ben, you've seen them up close. How do you think they're going to handle this pressure?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think that's why I'm intrigued to see how it's going to go. It can go obviously both ways. A lot depends on how quick they are out of the test, and obviously the first race in Australia. I think, you know, once we've got that out of the way, and if McLaren are still there at the top, which will be the first time in years if they come out of testing as the quickest car, because normally it's Ferrari or Red Bull, it's someone else. If they come out on top, then I think there will be a bubble around the team. The feel-good factor will still be there from winning the championship, and I think that will put them in a good place. And it is about managing that dynamic between the two. If they are struggling during that test, and I think it might be tricky. I think that the positivity and everything that's going on at Ferrari could well, you know, put them in the box seat and drive them forward. I think Red Bull still have a lot of work to do. But interestingly, I spoke to George Russell last week, and he is quietly confident about Mercedes. So I think the issue is really not what's going on at McLaren; it's what's going on elsewhere. And that will determine, of course, you know, whether they'll be championship contenders. And it will influence just the dynamic between the two. I just wanted to go back just to a point that you were talking about a minute ago about teammates. I'm just wondering whether, question for you, James, really, where do you think F1's changed? And the fact is that you now need teammates. I look back to F1 in the past, and teammates were, you know, just constantly at each other or not even, you know, they're either fighting each other or not close to each other. There was never any of this collaboration. And I think that I'm seeing now that you're reliant upon a teammate to help you improve your own chances. I mean, I'm looking back to last year and Red Bull and the difference between Max and Max Verstappen and Sergio Perez. And, you know, you can see that if you've got a teammate who's not helping, then you end up losing the Constructors' Championship. And I wonder whether F1's now changing in the sense that you do need to have two teammates working together as opposed to against each other. What do you think?
It's always been that difficult relationship, hasn't it? Because, you know, it's the first person you need to beat is your teammate because you're in the same car. But at the same time, there is that collaborative element that there is in a stick and ball sport where you're all in it together. And it's that balance has always been challenging. I think it changed as Formula One became more corporate through the 2000s. Obviously, some teams like Schumacher's Ferrari was all about Michael winning world titles, and the other guy was not exactly a passenger, but their sole job was to score as many points as possible, but just don't get in Michael's way. Other people don't really like that approach and have tried to be more kind of collegiate, and we've seen some pretty big fallouts as a consequence. I think what really drives it, though, in the end is how close the field is. So if you've got a championship like this one where the cars are all, the top four particularly, we're expecting to be very close together on performance, your weakest link is going to be the thing that's going to drive your constructor's performance. So, for example, not suggesting for a moment that Antonelli is a weak link, but he's an 18-year-old kid getting into a Formula One car for the first time. The pressure on him to be close to the sort of points tally at the end of the year that George Russell gets is going to be very big, but it's a big ask for an 18-year-old. Obviously, the same with Lawson going in at Red Bull. You know, that seat has failed, you know, repeatedly. Perez had a couple of decent seasons early on, but generally speaking, that second seat has failed for a very long time. So I think the pressure really is on that kind of collective effort. And that does shift the dynamic. So maybe that's what Andrea Stella and Zach were kind of most mindful of last year, and perhaps will be again. And we'll see what the consequences, consequences are of that. Just shifting it on though, Rebecca, your interview made some headlines last week because of what Zach said about F1 needing to professionalize on the race stewarding side. I think we've all seen plenty of examples of that. I know a lot of fans of the sport and people in the sport, stakeholders, find it frustrating sometimes. It's just not uncommon in sport. It's the same in other sports where refereeing decisions are challenged, or, you know, VAR in football and that kind of thing can be just as controversial. But let's dive into this a little bit. I mean, could you first explain for listeners who perhaps aren't familiar with the way the FIA structures these things, you know, how the stewarding actually works now? Who are these people?
So every race, the FIA appoints stewards. I think it's four or five, and they consist of people within the FIA, former drivers, and they are the people in charge over race weekends from the second the first car goes out in FP1 to lights out at the race, checkered flag at the race. And they interpret the racing and the rules and decide if penalties should be given out. They change every race. And there is a very strong argument, and I have to say I agree with Zach, that there should be a permanent panel of stewards, because we do see incredible amounts of inconsistency between the interpretation of the regulations. We could have a whole nother podcast about the regulations. They are constantly tweaked. It's all about interpretation. The conversation almost always comes up regarding Max Verstappen driving. He drives to the letter of the law. Mostly, I will caveat that with, he does it within the rules and regulations. He is absolutely bang on with his knowledge of the regulations, but it's the interpretation which makes it difficult and where the inconsistency comes in. And I know the argument is, well, football matches, they don't always have the same referees, but there are always football matches going on at the same time. So you can't always have the same referee, because over the course of a weekend, you have, you know, 20, 40, 60, if you're doing the whole leagues, matches happening. In Formula One, you have one race. That's it. And it happens every week, every other week. So you can have the same panel of stewards. And I, for one, completely back what Zach is saying. I think it is absolutely needed. Zach is offering to pay for it. So I imagine a phone call's already gone in about that from the FIA, because we know that they like people to pay for things. So I think it has to happen, because the FIA regularly, as Ben and I know, make headlines for all the wrong reasons.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair point. It's an interesting one, because it's interesting that he got in the line about he'd be prepared to pay for it, which he said a bit later on the same day, as long as it would make him unpopular with his fellow team bosses. But that kind of takes away the first argument that anybody within the FIA or elsewhere within Formula One might have as a counter argument. What's interesting about this situation is that typically the stewards come from presidents of clubs, because the FIA is an affiliation. It's a federation of clubs around the world, member clubs in each of the different countries. And that's what makes it a global federation. So often the stewards are actually, you know, the president of the Costa Rica Federation or the Venezuela Federation or whatever it may be. And so there's an element of kind of patronage there, isn't it? That part of the whole thing is that you get to have a nice weekend, you go to a Grand Prix, you stay in a nice hotel, and you kind of very close to the sport and you see it close up. And it's, to be fair to the current administration of the FIA, it has always been done that way. So they're not doing anything different from what was done in the past. But the sport is so professional now, there is so much money involved in it and so much attention on it, that inevitably this argument comes up now, doesn't it, Ben? And, you know, the teams are all awash with cash because they've got lots of sponsor income. Most of them have. And the TV revenues are high. And the cost cap means that their operational spending is capped. So what have you heard? What's the reaction of the other teams been to this suggestion of Zach's?
I think teams are supportive. I think, first off, that sounds like a wonderful jolly, doesn't it? Going to a Formula One race and staying in a lovely hotel and just going along for the fun of it. I think that needs to change. I'm really pleased that Zach stood up, and it takes someone to say it. And I think that you'll see a lot more teams supporting that idea as well. He doesn't seem to think it's going to cost too much. Teams obviously are indeed awash with money at the moment, fortunately. So I think that they're looking at a split payment between the teams, between F1, and probably between the FIA as well. I think that it does need professionals. They need to be also accountable for the decisions they make. I think that's the issue for me. We have so many decisions which are made and then not explained. And I think that, as a journalist, as a fan, is probably the most frustrating thing for us. I can only imagine that's even worse for a driver, seeing a different steward making a different interpretation of the rules. We should say that before, of course, the idea of the rotating steward was to stop favouritism and bias. But of course, it means it is subjective. And that rule book, as Beck mentioned before, like, you know, it does the, it's so convoluted that you actually, it's not about being subjective anymore. It's actually interpreting that rule book and having consistency, because while the teams are awash with money, Formula One is, a billion-dollar business now. And, you need to have consistency with the decision making, which is one of the reasons they brought in they call it the ROC, don't they? Which is the equivalent of VAR and the video referee. They've brought that in line to try and make swifter decisions. Is it working? Probably not at the moment. Probably not as they would have liked. I think the next step definitely is to have paid for stewards and a professional body. And as I say, accountability to explain the decision making, not only to the drivers, but also to us and the fans. That'd be really helpful.
How many times have you and I, Ben, been walking around the media centre hours after the race has finished and we still don't know the result of the race? I can't think of any other sports where it happens, where the fans go home and by the time they're tucked up in bed, they still don't know who actually won the race. And it's all these conversations that are happening and the processes and yes, okay, but just because that's always how it's been doesn't mean that that's the right way that it should be done. And the FIA needs to be looking into this because Formula One, as Ben says, it's a multi-billion-dollar sport. Formula One itself, they don't want it to be like this. They don't want there to be question marks over who wins it. They don't want the crowd and the audience and anyone watching to be confused about the rules and what's going on. And let's face it, it can be quite confusing at times. So I think there have to be better processes in place at the FIA.
I agree. I remember Daniel Ricciardo was third, wasn't he, in the Australian Grand Prix. And then there was this fuel flow row, which didn't get resolved until gone midnight. And I just thought it was crazy to think that all these people had come and watched him finish third, podium, great. I was working for a newspaper at the time. So all those, I was thinking from an Australian point of view, those newspapers would have been printed, Daniel Ricciardo third, they'd have been distributed. And yet the next morning they had picked up their phones and seen actually he was disqualified for an infringement. And it's just baffling to think that that exists. I mean, you couldn't go to a sporting event, be it 100 metres, well, I suppose 100 metres, you could say, as a drugs test. But, football, rugby, tennis, cricket, golf, if you've seen someone win and then only to discover, 6 hours later that they didn't win, it's preposterous, isn't it?
Talking of Danny Rick, do you remember when we left Monza and we ended up leaving at the same time as him a few years ago now, and it was after qualifying, and it was hours and hours after qualifying. And I remember leaving with him and we were just chatting and we said to him, do you actually know where you're starting the race tomorrow? And he just looked at us and he was like, fourth, is that right? Do you guys know? Do you know what's happening? And we just kind of walked out and no one really knew what was going on. And that's not great for the sport.
To be fair, a lot of those things would still happen even with professional stewards, because they're technical matters, or you have to hear from the drivers after the race or whatever. So maybe it is that the rules need to be changed and to simplify things, so to try and avoid that kind of thing as much as possible. But back of the envelope, I mean, you need three stewards, possibly could have a chairman who was an FIA person as well, just so they've got that some skin in the game. But the three professionals, you pay them $250,000 each a year, and then a travel budget for someone on that level in reasonable degree of comfort, just over $100,000 a year. So you're talking about only just over $1 million, which is, just over $100,000 per teams. And even if Formula One chipped in, they went 11 ways. It's not a lot of money, as Zach says, to make it happen. Do we see the FIA listening to what Zach has to say finally on this?
Do they listen to anyone? I don't know. I think that As soon as there's more noise, I think that they will be forced to listen to. Mohammed Ben Sulayem has addressed the issue. He said that he's all for this professional group of stewards, and he's obviously started his stewarding program, which we know that they need. But his reluctance was paying for it. Now, all of a sudden, Zach's come out and said, don't worry, I'm happy to stump up. We now need all the other teams to start saying, yeah, we'll stump up too. And then, of course, you go back to the FIA and say, look, teams are willing to stump up. Let's make it happen. And I think that that's where we're at. We kind of need the domino effect of the other teams falling in line. And then we can go back to the FIA and say, let's do it. Let's make it happen. And then it's up to them. And I think they will be forced to make changes and have to, actually have this professional group of stewards.
Okay, well, we'll wrap it up there. Remember, you can get in touch on at James Allen on F1 on X, or email us at jamesallenonf1@autosport.com with any questions or comments. We have this one that came in after our last podcast chat with Alpine team principal Oliver Oakes. This one's from Alex on X, and he said, Doohan is not a good option. Colapinto is much better. Oliver Oakes has no decision on the drivers. I'm not quite so sure that's true when it comes to that final part, but it was great to see both Pierre Gasly and Doohan at the Jack Doohan at the Autosport Awards last week. They were on fine form with very, very aggressive looking crew cut haircuts for the new season. But just to wrap it up then, what's our feeling about what's going to happen with Alpine's drivers in 25?
Oh, it's a tricky one, isn't it? They've got quite a list of reserve drivers, haven't they? They just seem to be signing them up, like Colapinto going over to add to the mix. Do and see isn't safe. I definitely agree with you, James, that I disagree with the comment that Ollie Oakes doesn't make any decisions. I think he very much does. It'll be one to watch. It'll be fascinating seeing, firstly, how they perform. That, you know, if Jack Doohan's performing, he'll keep the seat. Pierre Gasly, we know, is a race winner. So I think they'll be relying very heavily on him as the more experienced of the two. But absolutely guaranteed, in the background, there'll be some fights going on.
Yeah, and if you talk to people in the team, they say Paul Aaron is the one that they should be putting in the car. So there we are, another name in the hat.
Okay, well, listen, my thanks to Rebecca and Ben. You can read all of Ben's incisive writing on Autosport. My thanks to Dre, Matt and Jason on production. And thanks to you for listening. Please click to follow or subscribe. Leave us a rating or a review and tell all your F1 mad friends about us. We'll be back with another podcast very soon.